In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, a politics day transplanted to today, Thursday. From yesterday, of course, we had the inauguration coverage from NPR during this hour yesterday. Joining us, Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University in Des Moines, Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Chris and Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Ben.
We want to reach out to our listeners this hour, a good portion of this hour. If you are cooperating out there, we want to hear from you. What part of the inauguration day stands out for you? What will you remember most from yesterday? What moment or words do you think are especially relevant to our times? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Of course, a little bit later, we'll get our analysts' thoughts on the first female vice president sworn in yesterday, the first female vice president in U.S. history. But first, let's focus on Joe Biden as the president sworn in yesterday, offering a message of unity and restoration to a deeply divided country, a country reeling from a battered economy and a raging coronavirus pandemic that has killed more than 405,000 Americans. Let's listen to a portion of his inaugural speech yesterday. His main theme, unity. He spoke about how the U.S. has been tested many times before in its history and that this is our historical moment to come together.
Through Civil War, the Great Depression, World War, 9/11, through struggle, sacrifice, and setbacks, our better angels have always prevailed. In each of these moments, enough of us have come together to carry all of us forward. And we can do that now. History, faith, and reason show the way of unity. We can see each other not as adversaries, but as neighbors. We can treat each other with dignity and respect. We can join forces, stop the shouting, and lower the temperature. For without unity, there is no peace, only bitterness and fury. No progress, only exhausting outrage. No nation, only a state of chaos. This is our historic moment of crisis and challenge. And unity is the path forward.
President Biden yesterday, shortly after being sworn in, just a few moments after being sworn in. Chris, you start us off. Talk about this main theme, this call for unity, and what you heard in the president's speech.
Yeah, I think, you know, the call for unity, at least as I was listening, is really, it was a very emotional appeal, trying to get both voters and elected officials at all levels of government to take a longer-term view of political battles, of policy battles, to try to put things in perspective, to address the numerous crises that the country is facing. As you said, the pandemic, the economy, calls for racial justice. And so just a number of things facing the country, and the president really trying to boil it down into a single word, unity, to try to get people to take that long view, to look past bitter partisanship, as he said, to try to get real policy solutions. Because what the president was essentially saying yesterday is that if we continue down the path that's really been defined by polarization, and we've seen that in numerous studies over the last 10 to 20 years, we are going to continue to see gridlock, and policy gridlock is not going to get you anywhere in terms of solving crises. So if what the president is saying is that, look, if people want something to get done to address the economy, racial injustice, the pandemic, they're going to have to put aside those partisan feelings and really come together, as he said, in his word, in unity.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, add to Chris's words there.
Anybody who's been watching any of this, if you've missed the word unity, you are living in a cave. I mean, Joe Biden's trying to strike a new tone. He's trying to come into office with a clear, every president tries to define some sort of mandate. Joe Biden sees this as his mandate to be a healer, to bring the country together, to create a new tone and style of politics. The question is, can he be successful at that, number one? Mm-hmm. And number two, is that what people are really looking for? And I think there's a good portion of the country that is looking for that. I think there are, however, some deep divisions. And to a lot of those people who did not support Joe Biden, I think this rang hollow. And you saw this in some of the commentary from the right last night. And that's going to be an ongoing challenge for him. This is a democracy. Unity is not something that is easily achieved in a pluralistic democracy. And so now comes the hard part, which is trying to determine how to achieve some form of unity that allows policy to proceed.
Right. And so many presidents have spoken of unity. Remember the first inauguration of President Obama speaking of unity, and see where that turned in the course of 8 years of the Obama administration. President Biden saying, I guess to dispel the thought that he's Pollyanna in this, he said, you know, to some it may sound like a foolish fantasy, but he did, to the solution of how we get there, or his view of the solution of how we get there. Let's just quote from his address yesterday. History, faith, and reason show the way of unity. We can see each other not as adversaries, but as neighbors. We can treat each other with dignity and respect. We can join forces, stop the shouting, and lower the temperature there. So there is, Rachel, is there a path forward? Calling out, regardless of your political party, a call out to make this a departure, to make us treat each other in a different way, in his words, to have an end to this uncivil war.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting in looking at this is that there are a lot of different levels at which we're experiencing polarization and division. And I think one of the interesting things about listening to Joe Biden is that he really focuses in on the personal dimension of it, less than an institutional dimension. He wants to talk about people relating to each other as neighbors, that personal dimension, how we individually can engage with our fellow citizens. I am with Joe Biden on this. I would like to believe that there is a way to do this. And I think most notably, one of the things that the Biden administration seeks to offer in service of that goal is a milder form of rhetoric and engagement among White House staff and among the president himself, and setting that tone of a more quote-unquote normal, right, like kind of mm-hmm. older style politics. And you saw this at the press briefing yesterday. You've seen this in, obviously, Joe Biden's remarks. You've seen this in Kamala Harris's remarks. So this idea of just like evening out some of the rough edges that we've seen in our highest levels of political discourse with the hope that that will trickle down.
If you just joined us, Rachel Caulfield with us, as well as political scientist Chris Larimer. We're obviously talking about Inauguration Day and the what lays ahead in terms of challenges for this new administration. Join our conversation, especially if you have a moment from yesterday's Inauguration Day that stood out for you, something that you'll be watching, that you'll remember from yesterday. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or email us river@iowapublicradio.org. Chris, another theme here that we heard mentioned several times, emphasized in that speech of the new president. We've learned, he said, again and again, that democracy is precious. Democracy is fragile. At this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed. What power there, coming 2 weeks after an insurrection, the storming and occupying of the Capitol, Chris?
Yeah, and I think, you know, a very powerful statement, as he said, but there are going to be voters who are fully on board with that statement, and there are going to be some within the electorate who think democracy did not prevail. I mean, we've seen reports since the election for the last 2 months about, you know, when former President Trump was in office talking about election fraud. We've seen poll after poll up until last week where Republicans who supported the president continue to believe in significant majority that that the election was stolen. And so for some, if they look at it in terms of voting, they're not going to see this as democracy has prevailed. For others, they are. They are going to see that, you know, we did get past, as awful as the January 6th sort of storming of the Capitol was, that we got past that, that there was eventually a peaceful transition of power. But, you know, to Rachel's point, a lot of this comes down to individual leaders and the rhetoric, right? We know that voters take their cues from leaders. And so far, what we've seen from the Biden administration is a very different rhetoric than the previous administration in terms of a softer tone, as Rachel said, and a more personal appeal. The real challenge is, though, is once we get into governing, how do you get past polarization, as I said, both among elected officials and within the electorate? You know, we've seen last 15, 20 years of academic research in political science tells us just how difficult it is to overcome entrenched partisan attitudes, at least among voters who are active. Now, among voters who are inactive or who don't pay as close attention to politics, that's not necessarily the case. But among voters who are actively engaged in the process, there is still that bitter division. And it's going to take some time to overcome that.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, this aspect of the speech, please comment on it. What was not present? As far as I could tell, no specific policies, no mention of his predecessor by name. But we knew in some of the phrases what the president was talking about. Why this approach? What is the logic there? Without policies specifically, no mention of former President Donald Trump.
Well, I think this is a clear signal of turning the page on something. I think it's also an effort to turn down some of the rhetoric and not obviously antagonize the supporters of Donald Trump. I was struck as well in terms of the absences. I was struck, you know, in all of the programming around this inauguration. And just as a side note, I've attended the last six inaugurations. And so it is really weird to watch it on TV. I learned all sorts of new things. I saw a totally different side of the inauguration.
Wow, I didn't know that, Rachel. You've been in person in Washington for the past six inaugurations. Wow.
I have, yeah. And had every intention of going this year until circumstances prevented it. But I, you know, the programming on Tuesday night, the programming during the inaugural ceremonies, the programming last night, you know, there were a lot of images of real Americans and conversation about kind of bringing these disparate strands of American life together. What you didn't see a lot of is you didn't see a lot of the kinds of American life that have supported and been a part of Donald Trump's political movement, rural America, those small towns across the country where, you know, yes, coronavirus is hitting them hard, but they've been losing jobs for decades. They've been losing family farms for decades. They've been losing churches and community centers for decades. Schools have been closing. Those parts of America need, right, they need a sense that government can be a positive force in their lives. And the absence of that sense is exactly what fueled a lot of Donald Trump's appeal to those voters. And so I was really interested to see that while the cultural elites are back, you know, Lady Gaga, there she is with her giant gold bird. Right? You have John Bon Jovi back.
And that huge dress, yes.
That's right. You have the whole team back together. But you don't see a lot of conversation about those specific concerns that gave rise to Donald Trump. And I think that was a missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Your thoughts, your questions as this new administration starts its first full day, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Anne emailed us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. She writes, "My children and I listened to the ceremonies yesterday via NPR with a little viewing online as well. The parts that were most meaningful to us were watching Sonia Sotomayor administer the oath of office to Kamala Harris, but most especially listening to Amanda Gorman deliver her poem. How wonderful she did in capturing this moment in history. I know many colleague pastors who have been quoting from this poem across the nation, and I expect it may make it into more than a few sermons as well this coming Sunday." Chris, comment on that. That was really remarkable by this 22-year-old African-American Amanda Gorman. What a delight to watch, 6 or 7 minutes of her perform this poem.
It was a beautiful poem, and as you said, a beautiful performance of the poem. And I was looking, I think I saw on Twitter this morning that she had tweeted out that her books have reached number one, one of her books reached number one on Amazon just within the last 24 hours. But yeah, it was a beautiful poem, and it mirrored President Biden's speech a little bit in not necessarily, you know, not talking obviously about policy in either one, but really trying to in more of an emotional appeal to the entire country. And it really was a nice compliment to the president's speech.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our first caller. Summer is with us in Ankeny. Hi, Summer. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi.
Hi. What's your reaction to yesterday's inauguration?
I just feel like it was a breath of fresh air, and I could actually breathe with some relief once he was officially brought into office, inaugurated. And I feel like that sense is kind of not just within me, but a lot of the people around me.
Mm-hmm. And I get
a sense of ease.
Right. I get a sense, Summer, just hearing your voice, you're in a younger category of Iowan. Is that right?
Yep, I'm in my 30s.
Okay, very good. Yes,
but I will say, with him being brought into office, I mean, with the past 4 years, I have been so terrified to listen to the news and see what was happening next. But now I feel like more comfortable bringing up my children in this world, in this country again. I feel like there is a lot more hope, and I hope that everybody else around the country starts feeling the same way, because I really do feel like that there is a sense of positivity now back in our government, and a sense of, like Biden said, unity and wanting to bring everybody together and leveling the playing field for everybody. And it's not us against them or them against us.
Yep.
It's we're all working together, and teamwork is a huge thing for me.
Right. And Summer, will this the president's call change your behavior? I don't know what it was before this, but the way you react when faced with those who are not of your political opinion, will you take that to heart? And do you think others will as well?
I absolutely do. I, in my recent, experiences with people of other party or other views, you know, unfortunately, it hasn't been. It's just been very stagnant. And I hope that kind of people start to see and hear, you know, what Biden is able to do for everybody, and not just Biden, but also Kamala and the First Lady, because I feel like we've got a lot of people wanting to do things now and do things for the good of everybody. And I hope that people start to see that, because obviously actions will speak louder than words in this situation.
Of course, 4 years ago. Thank you, Summer. Of course, 4 years ago, it would have been Trump supporters celebrating the inauguration and asking those who didn't get their choice for the White House to join President Trump in seeing the world and the challenges the way they do. Let's go to Cal in Des Moines. Welcome to the program, Cal. Thank you for joining us. What do you want to mention about yesterday?
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my call. I was so impressed by Amanda Gorman. She was powerful, insightful, contextual. It's a little humbling for a 64-year-old to find inspiration from a 23-year-old, but she was wonderful and very proud. She's now part of our national conscience, very proud to have her as a fellow American.
Okay. Cal, thank you for your reaction from Des Moines. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Two or three minutes left before we go to break. Let's talk about a little bit more of the past, the feeling of yesterday to the actual crises. I mentioned at the outset the president naming six crises the U.S. faces: the virus first and foremost, climate change, growing inequality, racism, America's global standing, and an attack on truth and democracy, as named by the president. Rachel, talk about those. Of course, those crises, to some degree, interlinked. Which do you see as most challenging? Obviously, the president sees the virus as something that has to be dealt with in a completely different way.
Yeah, and the fact that he started today, his first full day in office, really focused on the virus. That's, I think, in his mind and in everybody's mind, that is the most immediate and pressing crisis that needs to be addressed before any of those other things become possible. And so we've seen him today really focus on that. He'll be making remarks in about 35 minutes on that topic. The White House, over the course of the next 10 days, will be laying out very clear initiatives in healthcare, the economy, and immigration, climate change. They're sticking to, they hope to stick to a very tight message calendar to really focus the nation's attention on solutions. He has, of course, already sent already given his blessing to an immigration bill in Congress. He's already laid out a $1.9 trillion relief plan for COVID. So I think he's trying to really put forward the idea that, you know, he is a pragmatic politician. And if you go all the way back to seeing him in Iowa in, 2019, which seems like forever ago now.
It does.
But, so many people saw Joe Biden. He wasn't the exciting candidate. He wasn't the passionate candidate. He was boring. He was stable. He was old. There were so many concerns about Joe Biden as a candidate. As it turns out, I think a lot of Democrats have come to think of Joe Biden as the right person at the right time, recognizing these pretty massive policy challenges that are faced by the country.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment with more from Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, two political scientists on board as we discuss politics this first full day of the Biden administration. What's on your mind? What did you take away from yesterday? 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we also want to talk about the historic Vice President Kamala Harris making history, first Black American, first Asian American, and of course, first woman to hold the second highest U.S. office. Back in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A transplanted politics day onto this Thursday because of inauguration coverage yesterday. Chris Larimer is with us, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University. We're entertaining your calls as well as we reflect on the new administration, this first day of the Biden-Harris administration. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Before we go back to callers, I want to play another little excerpt from President Biden's first speech as the 46th president. He spoke to the importance of embracing the truth and that people have a responsibility to defend the truth and defeat the lies.
Recent weeks and months have taught us a painful lesson. There is truth and there are lies. Lies told for power and for profit. And each of us has a duty and a responsibility as citizens, as Americans, and especially as leaders, leaders who have pledged to honor our Constitution and protect our nation, to defend the truth and defeat the lies. Look, I understand that many of my fellow Americans view the future with fear and trepidation. I understand they worry about their jobs. I understand, like my dad, they lay in bed staring at staring at the ceiling, wondering, can I keep my health care? Can I pay my mortgage? Thinking about their families, about what comes next. I promise you, I get it. But the answer is not to turn inward, to retreat into competing factions.
Okay. President Biden yesterday. Chris, let me go to you on this, because this is really a fundamental hurdle if we are to reduce the partisan atmosphere, not be so hyper-partisan. It's essential, and this is what the president is talking about, that we operate, we can have differences of opinion, but we operate from the same basic facts and recognize, all of us, that facts are important and there are falsehoods, untruths, lies, whatever you want to call them, as distinct from the truth.
Yeah, and you're right. This is, I think, going to be one of the most fundamental challenges for the Biden administration going forward. This is not something like the pandemic or the economy or climate change where he can start to push through executive orders or policies to try to address. This is going to take time to get at. And I have a quote here, and I apologize for reading the quote, but I'm in the middle of also preparing syllabi for classes next week, and it's a quote I'm going to have on one of my courses. But it comes from a book by Tom Nichols that was published a few years ago called The Death of Expertise, and I use this in class. And the quote is, "Americans no longer distinguish the phrase 'you're wrong' from the phrase 'you're stupid.' To disagree is to disrespect. To correct one another is to insult." And so, and that's the end of the quote. And I think that's going to take time to overcome, that mm-hmm. we are, because of the partisan rhetoric over the last, really heightened partisan rhetoric over the last 4 years, it is going to be hard to get past those partisan attitudes. As I've said before, everything from political science tells us that people's worldview is shaped almost entirely by their partisanship, that the way that they see facts is shaped by their partisanship. And that's going to be incredibly difficult to overcome. It's going to take time. It's going to take softer rhetoric by the administration. And it's going to take examples from leaders in Congress to actually come together to agree on certain policies to show people that when they get things done, it will actually help improve people's lives. But that starts with the highest levels of government. Just as the previous administration at the highest levels really heightened that rhetoric and made it very bitter political atmosphere, it's going to be up to the Biden-Harris administration to change that. But that's going to be the most difficult thing, I think, or one of the most difficult things going forward, is to try to move people past that. Because even within Congress, we've seen, you know, roll call votes over the last 15, 20 years divide to levels that we've never seen before, where there are no sort of, quote, moderate members of Congress. And that is, you know, bleeding down into state legislatures now, where we see state legislatures that are more reflective of what's going on in Congress in terms of the level of polarization. And so that is going to be a really long-term challenge for the Biden-Harris administration.
Okay, let's go back to our phones. Our hour quickly slipping away from us. Great discussion. A lot of input from our listeners. Let's go to our listener, Steve, in Cedar Rapids. Welcome to the program, Steve. Running a little bit out of time, but welcome to the program. What's your comment?
My comment is mostly about President Trump, the fact that he didn't show up at the election itself or the inauguration itself. And, you know, that shows a bad sign for not bipartisanship. And it's been over 150 years since an ex-president didn't go to the inauguration of the next president. I think that shows as a sore loser.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about that, Rachel, the fact that former President Trump was not there. He's and what he's been doing in his final hours. He's now in Florida. So the first president not to attend an inauguration since Andrew Johnson in the 1800s.
Yeah, there have been only 4 times in U.S. history that we've seen an outgoing president not attend the inauguration of an incoming president. The last time was 152 years ago. It is, I think, emblematic of how deeply contentious this transition was. We talk about this as a peaceful transition of power, and technically it was. A new person took power, and that happened without any bloodshed. That's a peaceful transition of power. But this was different than any other quote-unquote peaceful transition of power we've seen. We had 30,000, 50,000 troops surrounding the space, armed troops. We had just 2 weeks ago, right? We had armed individuals invading the spaces of U.S. government. This is a really different environment to bring a new president into office. And so of all the memorable things that we've seen over the past, I just want to, 2021 is only 3 weeks old, and there's been a lot to remember so far.
Yes.
Things aren't slowing down.
this
was a big one.
Yeah. While you mentioned the insurrection from 2 weeks ago, let's listen to a comment made by the former majority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, yesterday. He spoke about the insurrection on Capitol Hill, stating, and let's listen to it, that Donald Trump and other people in power provoked the mob.
The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people. And they tried to use fear and violence to stop a specific proceeding of the first branch of the federal government, which they did not like. But we pressed on. We stood together and said an angry mob would not get veto power over the rule of law in our nation, not even for one night.
This comment significant from Mitch McConnell. Rachel, what does this bode for work with Congress? Is there a corner being turned there, or by enough McConnell-like Republicans, I'll just say that, to work with this president? Is that the question?
I think that's part of the question. The Senate's still working out its power-sharing agreement, and so we're kind of anxious to see how the Senate will be operational during this time of 50-50 control. Of course, the vice president has a tie-breaking vote, so technically the Democrats expect that they, if they hold their coalition together, they'll be able to get what they need out of the Senate. But an impeachment trial would require, of course, a good number of Republicans to sign on to quote-unquote convict President Trump, former President Trump now. If Mitch McConnell were to vote to convict former President Trump in an impeachment trial, there seems to be some indication that there are Republicans who would take his leadership role away from him if they could for that. So I'm not sure where this places McConnell right now. But I do think it's an interesting indicator that there are some Republicans in Congress who are looking to turn the page and are looking for a different kind of relationship going forward.
If you just joined us, we're picking apart the politics of Inauguration Day and this first day, full day of President Biden's administration with Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, both political scientists. Let's go back to the phones and quickly get some opinions, some views, perhaps some questions from our callers. Dave is with us in Des Moines. Thanks for calling, Dave. What's on your mind?
Well, Mr. Kiefer made an off-the-cuff remark that I think downplays the rarity and sincerity of President Biden's appeal for unity. Mm-hmm. If you think back to when President Trump came into office, his immediate vow was to drain the swamp. In other words, throw out anybody who didn't agree with him. And before that, when President Obama was elected, the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, publicly stated, our main goal for the next 4 years is to assure that Obama is a one-term president. So I think that Biden's very sincere and open appeal to unity is not only sincere, but it's also rather rare in presidential politics. And I just wanted to get that on the record, that I think he's taking an unusual, a brave, and a useful stance by emphasizing unity. That's
thank
not
you.
Always been done.
Dave, thank you for your call from Des Moines. Let's go to our next caller, Phil in Ogden. Hi, Phil.
Hi there. So I'm a Jewish socialist, and I've had my name published online by Nazis. So like these are people who explicitly want to kill me. And calls for unity with the people who either implicitly or explicitly support them kind of ring hollow for me. And frankly, I don't really buy it when different people have dramatically different levels of exposure to danger.
Mm-hmm. And so, Phil, very quickly before we say goodbye, will you act any differently based on the president's call for unity, or is it pretty much the same going forward from your perspective?
Do I stop protecting myself from the people who want to hurt me? No, of course not.
Rhetoric, perhaps your engagement with those who disagree politically with you.
I mean, I don't engage with them. I do my own organizing and I try to help the people who I care about. But I don't engage with them.
Mm-hmm.
But okay. they very much want to engage with me. And so the idea that, like, this is someone I should extend a hand to seems kind of ridiculous.
Phil, thank you for your view from Ogden. 1-866-780-9100. Let's get one more caller in and then go back to our analysts. A variety of very interesting views. James, thank you for joining us from Des Moines.
Yes, a couple of things. The first one is nobody wants to admit they've been taken by a huckster. And IQ45, Liar in Chief, was the biggest huckster that I've ever seen. And I live next to the fairgrounds and walk that midway 10 or 12 times every year of the fair for 30 years. And this guy was good. The second thing is that if you insult me, I don't hear anything you say after you insult me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have to have a little patience as we're dealing with people and show them over and over and over again what the facts say about what they want to believe. And if you look at the research says we tend to believe things that reinforce our belief about something, even if that flies in the face of facts. And
okay.
So it's a long shot, but okay. I admire him for taking it.
James in Des Moines, thank you very much. Let's go quickly. Bill, we're running out of time. We'd sure like to hear your opinion, though. Please be concise. Welcome to the program. Bill, you're calling from Hudson, I think.
Yes. Hey, thank you. On the point of bipartisanship, there was a bill that was brought up to rename the Russell Senate Building after Senator John McCain, and Senator McConnell would not bring it to the floor. I think for bipartisanship, if President Biden, Vice President Harris, who both served with Senator McCain, if they would bring that up, I can't see why it wouldn't be a unanimous vote.
Okay.
And hopefully Bill. Our senators from Iowa would vote for it, too.
Bill
and
Hudson.
I just wanted your experts to opine on that.
Okay. They can opine away. Let's start with Chris. We heard so many different views there. Very interesting. Pick one to comment on, Chris. We're running out of time. About 5 minutes left of our program. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think, kind of the overarching theme between some of the calls there was just, again, how feasible is it to get to this point of true bipartisanship? And as I said, it's going to be difficult. One of the callers there mentioned, that there's research that people tend to it's hard to get people to move away from their pre-existing beliefs, that we have this sort of motivated reasoning bias, that we only believe what comes in and we discount anything that doesn't fit with our pre-existing beliefs, and that's generally right. And there have been studies where they try to persuade people to think about the other side, and the result has been that people actually dig in more to their own beliefs. So, I think it's going to be difficult. To the point earlier, though, about trying to show at least bipartisanship at the inauguration. What was interesting is following the inauguration, there was the clip of former Presidents Obama, Bush, and Clinton at the amphitheater at Arlington National Cemetery talking about bipartisanship, where you had three ex-presidents talking about that. And it was very clear, as you were talking earlier, you know, President Trump was not, former President Trump was not there, and he chose not to attend. And that just makes it, I think, all the more difficult to try to get to that point of bipartisanship if you have the former president just not even participating in the activities, not participating in that conversation. But I think, again, overall, I would love to see us to get to that point of bipartisanship where we move away from roll call votes that are strictly along party lines. But I think it's going to take time to see how that plays out, to see how Republicans, particularly in the Senate, look at the political landscape, because at this point they're thinking ahead to 2022 and the midterm elections there. For the Biden-Harris administration, they need to get something done, whether it's on the pandemic, the economy, climate change, or all three. But it's Republicans are going to be thinking ahead to 2022. How much do they cooperate on those policies to try to give the Biden administration something to run on in 2022, or for the Democratic Party to run on in 2022?
Rachel, I want to get to you for some concluding remarks in just a moment. I'll go to Jerry, though, in Cedar Falls quickly. Jerry, please, our hour is evaporating, but we have time for a quick comment from you. Jerry, go ahead.
Okay, well, I'll just comment on one thing. All the comments about Biden's empathy have made me wonder about the relationship between empathy and judgment, because he has never admitted to any mixed judgment and wrong judgment, including the Anita Hill thing. The only thing he said to her was he was sorry for what she went through. But he played the role in getting Thomas on the Supreme Court. So empathy and judgment. And he's not a leader that acknowledges wrong, is my view.
Okay,
hope that makes sense.
Yes, it certainly did. Jerry, thank you for your view from Cedar Falls. To Rachel now, as we conclude this very lively hour of popping, like popcorn the views is what I'm meaning here. Rachel, go ahead with some concluding remarks here.
Well, you know, what we witnessed this week is this national ritual, and it sets a tone for what we can expect from the new president, but also from ourselves going forward. This is absolutely not the end of something. I think the hope among the Biden administration is that it's the beginning. One of the things that I see most clearly is, yes, we have motivated reasoning bias and confirmation bias. We also have a fragmented media environment that is really encouraging us to stay within our very narrow range of what we find comfortable and believable. And watching last night, just shifting between the different news stations, was fascinating. You realize the extent to which, even in our quote-unquote mainstream cable news environment, the degree to which we live in our own little worlds. There are very different interpretations of what we're watching. And I think sometimes just realizing the degree to which that's happening is important for each of us individually. Mm-hmm. And coming to terms with it and being able to open our own minds. The former presidents that got together, the absence of Trump was absolutely remarkable. It was also remarkable that they came together in the first place. This is not a normal part of the national ritual, but it was a very intentional effort to demonstrate some sense of continuity, of stability, and of bipartisan working relationships.
Mm. Okay, Chris, what are the final remarks, thoughts you'd like to leave with us today?
Well, I think what Rachel said is spot on, and I would agree with her on everything. In addition to that, I guess I'm, you know, looking to actual actions in Congress and votes in Congress. How does this start to play out once policy proposals are debated in the U.S. Senate? And are there actually bipartisan votes? And long term, does that change the way votes unfold in state legislatures? As I mentioned earlier, what we've seen is that state legislatures are increasingly becoming more polarized and reflecting how things operate in Congress. Can Congress set an example for bipartisanship that then bleeds down into the states?
Mm-hmm. And Rachel, very quickly, how likely do you think Biden will have be able to peel away some what are left of moderates in the Senate and the House?
It's going to be
okay,
hard.
Okay, that's an answer.
No, it's going to be really hard. You know, Joe Biden, for all of his boringness, One thing you can say, he understands how Congress works. He understands the incentive systems of Congress. He understands the relationships that he needs to build in order to make Congress work with him. And that is, in my mind, that is his primary policy task going forward. How does he use the expertise and experience that he brings to the job in his policy making? It's not going to satisfy either side perfectly, but that compromise is going to be key.
Okay. The time tells us we're done for today. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, we appreciate your insights and a big appreciation for all the callers, the emailers, the input we had this hour. Thank you very much for joining our conversation, to our callers and to Rachel and Chris.
Thank you, and thanks to all of our callers.
Okay. You're welcome. Good to be with all of you.
River to River, produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.